Hi, Slave Is Gone listeners. Breezy here with Jericho to tell you about another podcast we think you'd like called The Slowdown. Each weekday, The Slowdown delivers short episodes that guide you to understand our common journey through poetry.
The Slowdown has had some great hosts. Ada Limon, who joined us on this show a few episodes back, and our special guest on this episode of The Slave Is Gone, Tracy K. Smith. And the new host is the award-winning poet and writer, Major Jackson.
Join Major Jackson for a hand-picked poem and a moment of reflection every weekday.
Produced by APM Studios in partnership with the Poetry Foundation, you can listen to The Slowdown now, wherever you get podcasts. I'm wife. I've finished that other state. I'm czar. I'm woman now. It's safer so. How odd the girl's life looks behind this soft eclipse. I think that earth feels so to folks in heaven. Now, this being comfort, then that other kind was pain. But why compare? I'm wife. Stop there.
This is The Slave Is Gone, the show that talks back to Apple TV's Dickinson.
I'm Jericho Brown.
And I'm Brian Janae, but you can call me Breezy.
We explore what's historically true, what's emotionally true, what works for us,
and what doesn't, in the Apple TV series about Emily Dickinson.
And because we're poets who are fascinated by Dickinson's verse, we always bring it back to the poetry. Hey, Breezy.
Hey, Jericho.
Are you ready to talk about eclipses, about congressmen drawing guns on each other, about not believing in God when everyone else around you does?
You know I am, especially because we'll get to talk about all of it with our wonderful guest, Tracy K. Smith.
And of course, we'll be hearing from our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray.
So let's recap. Season 1, Episode 9, Faith is a Fine Invention.
This episode begins with the Dickinsons in church. The pastor urges everyone to prepare themselves for death and to observe the solar eclipse happening later that day.
Emily's father writes home from Washington, where he's serving in the House of Representatives, and tells the family about a congressman who tried to shoot another congressman because he wasn't pro-slavery.
Sue's getting ready to get married to Emily's brother, Austin, and sees the seamstress, Betty, to be fitted for her wedding dress. Betty notices Sue's waist has gotten thicker, then clues Sue into the fact that she's pregnant. Sue sees how close Betty and Henry are with their daughter and feels at peace with the pregnancy.
Emily's sister, Lavinia, gives Joseph, the hot guy she's into, a nude sketch of herself, which she then shows to the rest of town. She responds by taking matters into her own hands and shares more nude portraits of herself with everyone in her art class.
Emily's love interest, Ben, has a terrible cough, but despite his illness, they go to watch the eclipse together.
During the eclipse, Emily and Ben anti-marry each other, promising to remain unwed for as long as they live.
It seems like almost everyone in Amherst watches the eclipse. Ben and Emily look at it through smoked glass. George Gould and his girlfriend observe it through a hole pricked in a piece of paper. Maggie sees it at the well, reflected in a bucket of water. Emily's mother ignores it and does the dishes instead.
Of course she does. Ben's coughing gets worse, and Emily brings him back to her house. Emily finds Maggie praying outside. Emily tells her that when she attended Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, she was the only girl in her class not to find Christ and get reborn.
Ben hallucinates flies buzzing everywhere, and Emily runs outside and talks to Death. She begs Death not to take Ben away from her and offers to give him a blowjob. He kicks her out of his carriage. She kneels outside the room where Ben is and prays.
You know, Jericho, this episode really got to me.
It's not easy. I mean, if you're a follower of the show, it's definitely the episode in which you are being told to cry your eyes out, right?
I didn't
like if you've been paying
that.
Attention. Yeah.
It snuck up on me. It snuck all the way up on me. And when she like fell on her knees outside of Ben's door, I was like, Lord, how dare y'all give me these feelings?
Yeah, and I couldn't figure out if I was emotional because of me and my love life, or because I had real sympathy for Emily's love life.
Well, I know for me, it was definitely because I'm in the process of breaking up with Sky Daddy, as it were. And this show really, really invites us to think about faith and think about sort of like, where do we go for help? If we don't have, you know, someone to pray to, like, what pulls us along?
Yeah, it is a show in large part about faith in ways that I didn't really understand until you just said that, you know, that really ultimately it's like, what can prayer or can prayer do anything? The show seems to be asking, and we even find out about this year that Emily Dickinson, the real Emily Dickinson, it seems spent at Holyoke in a seminary, right? So it's probably a good time for us to bring our guest and say, welcome, the former Poet Laureate of the United States of America and the Pulitzer Prize winner, my Aries sister, Tracy K. Smith. Hey, Tracy, how you doing?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
We're very well, thank you.
We're so happy to have you.
I'm really excited.
Tracy's one of my favorite poets.
All caps.
Favorite. All caps. Yes. All caps.
Let me read the rest of your bio because it's amazing. Tracy K. Smith is professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard. She won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for her collection Life on Mars and was twice named U.S. Poet Laureate. Not once, but twice.
Tracy launched the daily poetry podcast, The Slowdown, and has written librettos for two operas, one of which, Castor and Patience, had its world premiere with the Cincinnati Opera this past summer. Her forthcoming book of essays, To Free the Captives, will be published in September. You do have this new book coming out, and the book does have a lot to do with the fact of faith. I mean, individually, but also what is faith among a community, or what is faith if we think of a community in terms of its ancestors or our ancestors. Can you talk a little bit about that new book, but maybe also talk about how you felt watching these scenes that had to do with religion and faith in Dickinson?
Brief way of talking about what I think faith is doing in the new book. It's creating a through line by which I can be beside ancestors. And I use that term both in terms of the known, you know, I'm thinking a lot about generations of my family, but also the many unknown family and kin that I claim and whose experience I descend from. And the need for me to turn toward that largeness has to do with the weight and the confusion of living here and now in America, where our terms for collective enterprise don't really have a lot to do with the spirit. You know, one of the things that I feel maybe would link that to the series is the way that we're given a sense of the vast scope of what Emily Dickinson can lay claim to and how the vocabulary for that is interior, in some ways framed by silence, except for within the very insular, you know, intimate friendship. But it goes deep and it goes far, and we see things that trip it off, right? You know, a fly. And I don't know, there are so many moments. I have to say, I discovered this show through you. I was just so profoundly moved by so many moments that feel like a visual corollary to the huge leaps, cosmic kinds of leaps that happen in Dickinson's poetry. And to see it occur in the life of a young woman, to see it occur alongside this translated view of what popular culture feels like, it made me feel really excited and humble in a way.
As you were talking, Tracy, and talking about sort of spirituality as being a way to be alongside or be beside ancestors, that really spoke to me, because as I am breaking up with Sky Daddy, I absolutely refuse to break up with gospel music, because it is my connection to ancestry. It is my connection to this very real thing that has allowed my grandmothers to survive so much and still have joy, you know, and still bop around the house singing. And so it's been interesting to think about what it means to like parse those two, you know, and to hold on to that bit of ancestry, of like faith that was like given to me by my family. Also, and to have moments where I push back against it, you know, like I'll listen to songs like, you know, He's an On Time God, and the whole time I'm just like, but really? where was he though? That man is like notoriously late.
Doesn't that make him realer than somehow?
yeah, I love to dialogue, you know. But in, it is a way of like being in dialogue with your ancestors in some ways, to wrestle with that.
You're making me realize there are two vocabularies that intersect in different ways when we're thinking about, I believe, faith as a shared site. When I think about it within kinship, it's my love for the people I know and have known that makes that other cosmic love feel real. It's evidence of it. Mm-hmm. And when I turn, if it's a gospel song, if it's something that I'm turning to that's received from my mother, my aunts, my grandparents, when I'm low, it's a way of leaning on them and on what they lean on. And I can really understand that's different from turning to Sky Daddy as received and as marked or claimed through other lives and vocabularies that I might not feel myself to be, I don't know, trusting of, if that makes sense.
It's interesting because in Dickinson's poems, God is always assumed, it seems to me, or at least I felt that way as a kid reading Dickinson's poems. I really did feel like this is a person who believes in God, because God shows up in the poem as if God is, given the poems I was reading as a kid, seemed to believe in God much more than she believed in the fact of a family. I mean, you don't see a father or a mother showing up in Emily Dickinson's poems. Maybe now's a good time for us to bring in our rogue scholar and ask Aoife. How you doing, Aoife? Ask Aoife about it, the real Emily Dickinson's relationship to religion and to faith. Was she a believer? Also, this moment that we find out happens to Dickinson at Holyoke. We find this out when Maggie's outside praying Catholic prayers, and she tells
you can go in the house.
I don't want to pray in that Protestant house. It's really, can you talk to us a little bit about the real life faith of Emily Dickinson, but also about what happens in that real household? Would there have been a Catholic person working there, and would that Catholic person have had to pray outside if they wanted to pray?
So let me read something that Dickinson wrote in a letter. They are religious, except me, and address an eclipse every morning, whom they call their father. So throughout her life, they had daily Bible recitations before breakfast. They had evangelical revivals in town, which is what's occurring when she's at that Mount Holyoke Seminary. And her father carried a note in his wallet to the day he died that marked the day he accepted God. So she's in a climate that sets her apart from the majority, but it also says something about her enormous will. And yes, there was a Catholic maid who worked and lived under their roof, but the praying outside would have been to get away from employer scrutiny mm-hmm. and conversion pressure, which was mm-hmm. quite enormous. Protestants did not like Catholics under their roof, and they wanted to bring them in, which is a form of control that they had practiced on the indigenous population of New England. Mm-hmm. So they had good skills in that department. The Irish, you know, at this period of time, there's German Catholics arriving and there's Irish Catholics, but the Irish Catholics were arriving from a colonized country. So they already had that pressure or laws against their faith, their language, etc. So there's a bit more resistance mm-hmm. that you might see in German immigrants. And I want to say, every time I see that church scene where they show white and one or two black parishioners in the church, this is a period of time when the black residents of Amherst have already founded a black church, which actually morphs into two black churches, which actually, 2 centuries later, still exist. Hope and Goodwin Church still exist. Mm. And it's actually around things like segregation of seating, and also the black parishioners want to vote. They want to be part of, and there's a pushback by the white congregational parishioners. So the black community of Amherst forms a new church. So I find that those scenes kind of interesting.
It's also interesting that Maggie is the person that is sort of invites this like confession, you know, or this emotional moment, that she's the one that's able to hold this. And it's like always the other in the show who is doing the emotional lifting mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or allowing for some sort of like emotional movement. You see that too with Sue a little later mm-hmm. when she goes to the dressmaker and mm-hmm. is magically cured of her fears of becoming a mother by seeing magical, happy black family.
Like one episode later, right?
Mm-hmm. Wasn't she just afraid to be of dying? You know, in an episode that is so much about death, mm-hmm. Sue is magically like, oh no, I'm not afraid of dying in childbirth. You know, we've got medical care for, we've got gynecology now. No, y'all don't. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
I read a couple of things that have a lot to do with the presence of proximity or intimacy with death that in each of those moments. When the eclipse was being watched, and the ways that everybody watched the eclipse was really moving and terrifying to me too. Maggie had the most, to my mind, beautiful and poetic relationship yes. to it. And we know that it is also, you know, something that links her dead husbands. And so to turn and look at the eclipse reflected in well water was exquisite to me. And it also reminded yes. me of Emory Howe poem in The Voice of Mary, the mother of Christ, when she was a young woman. That poem brings her to life in a really rural way. And so she's tending chickens and sheep, and she sees the moonlight reflected in that water. And for her, that becomes an emblem of the divine. Mm-hmm. And that was really moving to me. And the scene with Sue and her family, they also, as a Black family in this period, death is an adjacent presence. There's something mm-hmm. in my mind, right? And so to have the fullness and unabashed family love happening mm-hmm. in that moment, mm-hmm. there's an affirmation that there are some things that are worth, you know, yeah. like claiming despite what we know they're bordered by. And that felt really interesting to me.
I think that's supposed to be that magical moment, right? When Sue sees Maggie with her child, that's supposed to be the thing that turns everything. How interesting it is that Sue finds out that she's pregnant because she can't fit a dress.
Well,
hey, that's sometimes how it happens.
Yeah. I mean, at least she didn't find out in the middle of giving birth. I've heard those "I didn't know I was pregnant" stories. That stuff used to like scare me. Like, I was going to the bathroom at the club and out popped a baby. So this seemed reasonable to me.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I got caught up. The other person thinking about a man instead of paying attention at church is Lavinia. Mm. And Lavinia is thinking about this boy. Is this a real person, by the way, Aoife? What's his name? I can't remember the character's name.
Joseph Lyman. There was a Joseph Lyman.
Was he a ladies' man?
If I remember correctly, he was a beau of Lavinia's. And I think that they came very close to marrying. I hope he wasn't like the Joseph in the show, though.
Hey, this guy's awful, though. Why would you
really
do that?
Is. I kind of appreciate the show, like, showing that or taking it on, because it just made me think of actual real teenagers watching the show. Mm-hmm. And the reality that this is, like, something that young girls experience. And also, I just loved how it ended, though, that she, like, put her pictures all over. Because when she was sitting before that fire, I was like, don't do it. Don't burn them, girl. They're beautiful. You know, like now they all know you have beautiful boobs. There's nothing wrong with that.
She called her thick.
You know?
She said, yeah, you're thick.
You know, she wanted it. Is what it was.
Yeah, she clearly was jealous. She was jealous. The scenes of death or of sickness in this episode were not necessarily easy to watch and really got surreal to the point of actually showing the flies on the face of Emily's lover, which, by the way, she has just married or unmarried, I guess. But anyway, you look at it.
That was such a beautifully gay moment.
I think something about Emily's refusal to be a part of anything traditional, particularly union and love, as we traditionally know those things, for her.
And
to
also
be able
to say, I'm going to propose, you know, like if we're going to do this, we're going to reverse all of the roles. We're going to buck against all of the norms and define it for ourselves.
But what did y'all think about that scene with Death, though? So Death hadn't been around in a little while, it seems to me. I hadn't seen him. And he comes, and it's so funny how the buildup is. It's almost like Emily is driven to go see, like suddenly she's in this red dress she didn't expect to be in. And she's running. It's like she's running outside, but she can't stop herself from running or something. It's really weird, right?
I really appreciate the surrealness of the image, though, to be in this moment of just like anticipatory grief of like knowing you're about to lose. And to be transported to the point where you physically look different and go confront death. Like I appreciate visually what they're doing there.
The images of that, it could be like a very over the top perfume commercial or something.
Yeah, totally.
But it also, you know, there's something really gothic. And then the terms or the expectations that she brings, death says, no, that's not what this is. And that was actually really, I don't know, really exciting to me to see this beautiful black man. And in the beginning, like he's taking a sip of something. It's like, what? And then the emotions shift so quickly. And then to realize this is even larger than Emily.
I mean, there's a way that it feels really transgressive or like it pushes back against that narrative of like all black men must want a white woman. It's this moment of he's like, no, this is not about you. Something about it was really unexpected. When she threw herself at him, I was like, girl, get up. No.
He was unbuckling his pants, right?
Yes.
I was like, oh my. I was like covering my face. Like, oh, what is happening on my nice little show?
Yes. I was like, babe, get up.
Way too much for me.
Yes.
It was really very sad because it's like, why have we been hanging out so much if you can't help me out, Mr. Death?
Yeah.
That's how I felt about it. But you're right. I think what I do, one of the things that I love about this show is that the show allows Emily Dickinson to be just as privileged as she might have been, right? Mm-hmm. And so she does these things where she's approaching Maggie in earlier episodes, approaching Henry.
I mean,
and
she literally
in this case, even approaching Death in this way where she expects that everything is centering her. And then finds out. I mean, she even tells Maggie, you can never quit this job.
Yes.
And Maggie looks at her like, okay.
Excuse you? Yeah. I was like, get a therapist, my dear.
Thanks to Smith College for its sponsorship of The Slave Is Gone.
Smith first opened its doors to students in 1871.
when Emily Dickinson was still living and writing up the road in Amherst.
And just like no one at that time would have imagined that Emily Dickinson's poems would be read around the world, they'd probably also be surprised by the impact this women's college continues to have more than 150 years later.
Smith's faculty, students, and community of alums are driving change in the world, making knowledge a force for good.
Whether you're a parent, a prospective student, an academic professional, or someone who counts yourself as part of the Smith community, learn about Smith now at smith.edu.
I think now is a really good time to hear a poem from Tracy K. Smith. Tracy, will you read a poem for us?
Yeah, I'd love to. I want to read a poem called The Angels. And in some ways, what makes me want to read it is the image and the character of death, the power, the mystery, the largeness, and the blackness. In which that figure is situated. And maybe one thing I'll say before I read it, when you have people on the other side, when you have surrendered people you love to death, you have a bargain with that thing. You have a relationship to death. It means something and it knows you, even though the terms of it are illegible, you know, in their full. So maybe this is part of what this poem is bearing witness to. The angels. Two slung themselves across chairs once in my motel room, grizzled in leather biker gear, emissaries for something I needed to see. I was worn down by an awful panic, a wrenching in the gut, contortions. They sat there at the table while I slept. I could sense them with a deck of playing cards between them. To think of how they smelled, what comes to mind is rum and gasoline. And when they spoke, though I couldn't, I dared not look, I glimpsed how one's teeth were ground down almost to nubs, which makes me hope some might be straight up thugs, young, slim, raw, who bounce and roll with fearsome grace, whose very voices cause faint souls to quake. Quake then, fools, and fall away. What God do you imagine we obey? Think of the toil we must cost them, one scaled perfectly to eternity. And still, they come, telling us through the ages not to fear. Just those two, that once, and never again for me since. Though there are there sightings, flashes, hints. A proud tree in vivid sun. Branches swaying in strong wind, rain hurling itself at the roof, boulders, mounds of earth, mistaken for dead does, lions in crouch, a rust-stained pipe where a house once stood, which I take each time I pass it for an owl. Bright quarrel, so dangerous and near. My mother sat whispering with it at the end of her life, while all the rooms of our house filled up with night.
Come on. That's my favorite poem in that book. I love that poem. Yeah, I love that poem, Tracy. I love it. What I love so much about that poem is that there's a moment where the poem says, you know, the real work of angels, and that they come and they tell us, you know, fear not. And it's so funny because in that moment, you realize that the poem has become an angel, that the poem itself is literally doing the same work that those biker angels were doing at the beginning of the poem. It's like, oh, well, let's go hang out over there. Let's comfort, You know what I mean? And that poems have that kind of power and remind us, when the poem itself becomes a sighting or a sign, it seems to me, of angelic work. And I love that about that poem. You know, it's a, that reminder that fear not, you know, I like that.
That's so nice when brilliant people tell you what your poems do. In my sense, when I look back at that poem now, I see it as evidence of just how miraculous death and the other side are. And I don't know, there's something that feels like a privilege to see the glimmers of it, or to suspect it, even if you're wrong. And I think because in my imagination, it's really a gateway to something, you know, and that's something that I feel that Dickinson claimed in her own vocabulary.
It's when we think about miracles, we think about these sightings, these signs, and the ways in which that you use nature, the natural world in that poem. It, of course, brings up something else going on in this episode, and that is the fact that everyone is getting ready for a solar eclipse. Mm-hmm. And even the church has found a way to commandeer the eclipse, you know, like, oh, this is God's work, and we're all getting together to see this sign as a sign of God on earth, you know. And it is beautiful to see all the different ways people are trying to go about watching the eclipse.
I loved too that they had this eclipse in this episode about faith, because I think a lot about the ways that I like have watched friends and like feel myself sometimes, you know, leaning on astrology, but also just like looking around us, you know, for like other things to give us comfort, you know, other certainties. When you were talking, Tracy, about sort of needing to, or about like the role of death, there is a way it resonates with this idea of just like, it's our certainty, you know, just it's the same certainty of like, that an eclipse is going to happen, the same certainty that like a sun is going to come up, that the wind is going to shake the trees. And I love that the show sort of invites us to like think about those together, and that it does become very beautiful.
Aoife, am I remembering correctly that in the passage you read, Dickinson describes the parishioner's view of God as an eclipse that they turn to every day?
Right. They are religious except me and address an eclipse every morning, whom they call their father. Yeah.
And also that who they call their father. Yeah. It's just like Sky Daddy, Sky Daddy, Sky Daddy.
One of the things that I think is so fascinating about this, the minister takes that moment and makes it a religious moment.
Yeah.
And this is a time when, right, it's an evangelical moment, and membership in the church is tripling between 1800 and 1860. Mm-hmm. But it's also a time when there's an increased interest in science, but they're compatible, right? Because that's a great moment when the minister said, you know, encourages the celestial event. So it's really interesting, not with the totally, what I want to say, totally conservative, let's say Puritan-like faith and Roman Catholicism, but the majority of Protestants are embracing the science, right?
The eclipse is sidelined in that particular vocabulary by Dickinson, and religion in the same moment. And the scene at first, Maggie says, do you want to pray? And she's like, it's not really my thing. And yet we know there's this immense spiritual imagination and a cosmic obsession and interest. And so I love that there was a moment in that scene in the barn where I was like, I want her to profess that she believes in something else in a moment, but it's sidelined and it's private in both of those moments. And it denied these incorrect vocabularies, which in some ways, it's like we need poetry to give us a calibrated vocabulary for the actual poetry as unco-opted by these other institutions, you know?
Yeah, I think that probably would have been true for the real Dickinson too, right? That, you know, if you think about what Emerson is saying about God and religion and Christ at this time, and if you think about what Thoreau is saying about God and religion and Christ at this time, so it's also interesting to think about the fact that Dickinson herself while attending churches and doing this daily, you know, the daily reading that you were talking about before, Aoife, would also be questioning what the limits of that were and whether or not you could broaden that.
This is the faith episode in a time when religion was so important, because I think it's a really big miss by the show that religion is so absent, except for this episode. And religion was so dominant in their lives.
Was Mary Lyon a real figure?
Yes. Yes.
And would she have been so awful to Emily Dickinson?
I think so, yeah. Very probable.
So we don't know that that experience is a real life Dickinson experience, but we also don't know that it wasn't, given what we know about Mary Lyon. Well,
no, apparently they did have these. Yes, she was called a no-hoper, and they did have these sessions where the girls would stand up.
Lord.
And Dickinson wouldn't stand up.
Yes. So doesn't that say something about her will?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But these moments are not so hard to fathom. Have you ever been to church camp before? Like,
it's still going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit just from the eclipse, Aoife? Would it have been a big dating event? I noticed the eclipse on the show, the eclipse is just full of couples. It seems like this moment where you really announce to people, this is who I'm with, because this is who I'm watching the eclipse with.
Well, isn't every moment a dating moment?
I hope so. I hope so.
But yeah, big social. Yeah, it was a really big social event. And especially in the town of Amherst, because Amherst had an observatory. There were two astronomy professors in Amherst College. But you know what was really interesting about the show is both Emily and her mother were really keen on science and math. So I thought that was a really interesting departure, but it's television.
I thought it was interesting that both her mother chose not to participate in the eclipse. And then in the moment that Emily tries to help her friend, says, don't bring death into this house. It speaks to like in this character that they've written, this sort of like narrowness of spirit, you know, that like you can't stop and like look at the sky. You can't stop and care for a friend. It's like wild how connected those seem.
I hardly have any patience for Emily Dickinson's mother in this show. But I will say, I did love how Dickinson's mother, and there was another character in the room at the time. Oh, it was Maggie. When they were talking about hearing that cough, how they said, oh, when you hear that cough, you know, death is on the way. You know, we're sort of being told the episode before and this episode, the guy's not going to make it. And so as a person in the midst of a pandemic, when Emily's mother's like, don't bring death in my house, I am taking that literally. Yeah. I mean, you know, Emily, this guy's got this horrible cough. Nobody is a doctor. And it seems to be like, why are you in his space? Emily goes a step further. I find it funny that it doesn't come up. Everybody's supposed to think this guy's married.
Yeah. Would that have been a scandal? You know, like would she have been getting that little scarlet letter stitched on her?
They were holding hands at the eclipse. Everybody would have been there.
Mm. Yeah.
They literally grabbed each other's hands like as in a wedding proposal.
Right. Well, yeah.
That would not have. I mean, there's no. I mean, we're talking about 18. What year are we? What year is the eclipse?
Well, there was an eclipse. It was actually in the summer, but there was a 3-minute and 41-second eclipse in the afternoon of 1851, July of 1851. So obviously they're in the wintertime on the show, but this was the longest one I could find. It was unusual, and it seemed to capture what the show was doing, which was a several-minute-long eclipse. And Sue and Emily, because they're born 10 days apart, Sue and Emily would have just turned 20. Why would it be different then, that if somebody is going, you know, two people, he's cheating on his wife, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, you know, people then, people now, they don't like it.
I like the way you describe that, is this whole scene is an eclipse. And maybe what the imagination of the work is doing is allowing the subjective experience to eclipse all of the sense of propriety, and for us to be in this one of the last possible moments with the two of them together.
One of the things that they do in this moment is recite a poem together.
You know? Yeah, that's really beautiful.
I love their response to the poem too. It was so creepy.
Yeah. On one of, you know, the dating apps that I use, it asks you to describe what the experience of dating you is like. And I put a slow but persistent introduction to contemporary American poetry. Because if you leave the relationship with nothing else, you will leave the relationship with more poems than you entered it.
That's so nice.
Love it.
And so I don't know. I love this idea of just being able to recite a poem with a boo. It feels like exquisitely romantic. We could touch on the gun on the floor of Congress if we wanted to.
Oh, yes.
Why was he pulling a, obviously, you know, pulling a gun in a public state house, you know, which is something we're dealing with now, people pulling guns out in crowds. What would he have been pulling the gun out for and about, Aoife?
The show says it's over the Missouri Compromise.
Yeah. The Missouri Compromise when it was in 1820, but even in 1854, 1856, they're still arguing the Missouri Compromise. And the Civil War is already, in a way, being fought in Kansas and Nebraska. I mean, the country has erupted in certain places. So a fight erupts on the House floor over the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And these are two allies, William Churchwell and William Cullum. They're both from Tennessee. Churchwell thinks that Cullum is supporting free soil interests, and that's why he pulls out the gun. Cullum jumps over his desk, and the only reason that Cullum is alive is because Burton Craig of North Carolina steps in and grabs the gun.
Did he have any consequences? Like, did he pull out a gun and then come back to work the next day? Like, what's up?
No, because he and Cullum both came in and apologized. And then two rules come into play. One is no concealed weapons in Congress. And then in a kind of light, jovial kind of response, the sergeant at arms sets up a table outside of the halls of Congress so that anybody who is like completely committed to carrying concealed weapons has to put them on this table before they go into the chambers.
This moment where Sue can't fit her dress because she's pregnant, and she finds this out from Betty. Would the dressmaker for Sue have possibly been a Black woman? And would that Black woman have been able to be as playful in this moment as Betty is with Sue? I mean, Sue doesn't seem to even catch on to the fact that Betty's sort of poking fun at her, you know, and she says, oh, I get hungry too. You know? Mm-hmm. I was like, what is going on in this scene? What are the possibilities for that, Aoife?
I think there's a possibility that there could be a Black seamstress, because the majority of women in Amherst who are Black are doing household work. But could there be someone who's a skilled seamstress? Yes. Mary Todd Lincoln had a close confidant in a Black seamstress at about this time. Mm-hmm. So I think they're coming off of that person, Elizabeth Keckley. So she could have. I mean, so here's the thing that I've thought a lot about is how far can you go with the most powerful family in the region, because the Dickinsons were, and partly because I think about Wells Newport, who was a Black stable hand for the Dickinsons. And in a letter, Dickinson writes about Wells Newport has disappeared. And I think a lot about that, because she never mentions him, but he ends up migrating back to Amherst, but he's disappeared from their job. And then gets replaced by a man named Jeremiah Holden, who is also a Black stable hand, laborer for the family. And I think you have to really disappear if you've pissed off at Dickinson, because they're so powerful. Mm. So how far can Betty go? And I suspect, if the show is really being accurate, this might be the way Betty can push the envelope slightly, is that she can tease the not yet married, but keep it in a certain zone. Mm-hmm. So that it doesn't piss Sue enough so that she would then go and say something to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So she mm-hmm. keeps it in that really, that's what I've been thinking about.
One thing I've been thinking about is sort of in what ways Betty is sort of performing a lot of tropes that we see of Black women in media mm-hmm. and literature all the time. Mm-hmm. In some ways, you know, her little teasing feels very sassy Black friend. Mm-hmm. But also it feels very mothering in some mm-hmm. ways, mm-hmm. and that she sort of is the presence that helps mm-hmm. Sue come to terms with the idea of pregnancy, and it's giving a little mammy mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. role too. And it would be interesting to see the show be able to critique that, but I don't know that it's quite that self-aware. It's tricky because it did resonate too, what you said, Tracy, earlier about it being very affirming and to see a Black family that, like, despite their proximity to death, is clinging to the sweetness of their love, of their ability to be tender with one another.
Mm-hmm. Which we know is what is done, but you're right, it does become a performance because of the choreography in mm-hmm. the space. Place.
Yeah, I mean, it would be different if this show was about that family. Then they can give us the nuance mm-hmm. of and allow us to really appreciate how hard they have to fight for that tenderness, you know, and like the what it takes to sort of not bring the bitterness that the world puts in you into your sacred space that is your family and your loved ones.
I mean, do you feel like a show that's as imaginative as this could make space to take yes. that on, you know? Yeah, it's a yeah. choice.
And these things have real world consequences, because I swear the number of people I meet that think because they perceive me as being under the realm of like Black womanhood, that I am a great space for all of their feelings and, mm-hmm. you know, requirements or need for emotional labor. And I'm willing to give that to my friends, and I'm willing to give it to a lot of strangers too, but I don't like that expectation, you know?
You know, again, this is all learned from mm-hmm. performance. And so mm-hmm. it becomes something to consume as opposed to rise to the occasion of and change.
We always end our show with a question for the poets from Aoife. What is our question today, Aoife?
Who is the ideal audience for raw work? Who do you let in? When in the making process? What's it like?
There are for certain friends that when I've like just written a poem, I'll call them and be like, can I read you a poem? Mm-hmm. Because somebody needs to hear this. And they're people I trust, you know, and people whose work I know, and people who know that in those moments, I'm mostly just looking to be affirmed and maybe to be pointed in a slight direction. Yeah. But I don't know. I can't think of audience, you know? You make a poem and it goes out into the world and then you make some more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the pre-audience that you're asking about. It's the who is another, like a ring of myself, you know, like mm-hmm. rings. Who is one? And I mean, Jericho, you're one of my people, you know, it's someone I love, who loves me and who also yeah. knows, yeah, the praise, the encouragement, and also knows when I know better. And at some yes. point say,
yes,
when I'm ready to hear it, you know better.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I love a friend who can be like, you know, you don't need all those it's. Why you got all them damn hits in the poem?
That's very funny. Aoife, you bring up the word raw, and it's so interesting how, like, when you're a poet, or maybe Tracy and Breezy have a different experience, and y'all can talk about this if you do, but I know my experience of a poet is I never think anything is done. Like, I'm all everything is out there, like,
yeah.
something could happen to change. though you have been in a magazine, something could happen to change you.
Yeah.
There's a reason that I might take a line out. There's a reason I might add six lines. Something could happen. And I don't know.
I sent a poem to an editor and it had a line saying that I had to forgive my mother. And I woke up in the middle of the night and was like, release. The word is release. It's not forgive. It's release.
Yeah.
You know, and like, yeah, I definitely have moments years later where I'm like, oh, no.
It takes you a while to understand what the poem is saying, what it brings, what intention it brings. And it's sometimes it's like satisfied to let you know what you know. And then sometimes it calls you back and it's like, you don't hear me. Please, this is about releasing. How about you? About her. And that's exciting. I love it. And I really love being able to participate with one or two others, even in that, you know, like, oh my God, this is still talking to me and it's correcting me.
Yeah. And there's something about like those friends who know your work and know what you're thinking about and are thinking about like tangential things. I'm writing my Sky Daddy poems right now, writing this breakup. And there are friends that I'm just like, who we've always talked about faith and we've always talked about all this stuff. And I'm just like, I need to talk about this with you because they are the people who know, oh, go read this, go read that, go read, you know, it's something comforting about those friends who know your internal world and know how to add to it to help push your work along and your thinking and your feeling along.
There was a piece of punctuation when I was turning in, actually, my first book. We were at the last stages of the final revisions before the book was gonna go to the press and finally come out and be something that I could hold in my hand. And I'll never forget, there had for a long time in a poem, I think the title of the poem is Grip, but there had been an M dash. And I changed that M dash. I had been talking with the editor about this moment and not having the exact right piece of punctuation. And she changed it to a colon. She said, oh, what about a colon? And I don't know why I'd never thought about a colon before, but I remember looking at that colon and reading that poem and saying to myself, oh my God, my book is done. Fixing that one piece of punctuation in one poem made me feel like all the poems were finally no longer what you just said, raw, Aoife. And then once I got that right, I felt great. I felt like, yes, print the thing.
Amazing.
One thing that you just can't get right in a poem is just like, will be a rock in your shoe.
Right.
Until you do.
Until you do, yeah. But it's also how you know not to let the thing go until you get it right. You got to get it right. Tracy, thank you so much for being here with us.
Oh,
it's been a real
thank
joy.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's real genius you gave to us. Thank you.
It's been wonderful.
What a blessing to be here with you guys. I'm so grateful.
Thanks for listening to The Slave is Gone, where we continue the conversation started by Dickinson and go way beyond.
That's Brion Janae. Their first book is After Jubilee. And they're the author of Blessed Are the Peacemakers, which won the Caveh Canem Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize.
That's Jericho Brown. His book, The Tradition, won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His other books include Please and The New Testament. Thanks to our special guest on this episode, Tracy K. Smith.
Her forthcoming book of essays, To Free the Captives, will be published in September. Our rogue scholar is Aoife Murray, author of Made as Muse, How Servants Changed Emily Dickinson's Life and Language. Aoife and Lisa Rothman are the show's executive producers.
Matt Martin produces the show. Mary Ann Zahorsky and Celia Bolgatz engineer and edit our audio. Marissa Budlong and Anna Smith are our researchers, and our interns are Lola Anaya and Maggie Olszewski.
Dr. Marilyn Nelson and Dr. Terry Bonhorst Blackhawk are our advisors, and the show receives support from Mass Humanities and the Massachusetts Cultural Council.
Thanks to the many individuals who contributed to make this episode possible. You can give your support with a donation at theslaveisgone.com.
And a final thanks to Catherine Whitcomb and everyone at the Jones Library in Amherst, as well as to the Boutel Day Poetry Center at Smith College.
We are on Twitter and Instagram. Follow us for bonus materials that take you deeper into Emily Dickinson's life and art and the world she lived in.
We'll give her the last word.
Faith is a fine invention for gentlemen who see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency.